103.2 Dublin City FM. This is Mental Wealth with Brian Green. Good afternoon. On today's programme, I'll be talking with Dr. Andrew Morris. And Dr. Andrew Morris is coming over to Dublin on the 3rd of May for a one-day course in the Royal Marine Hotel in Dunleary. It's an all-day course about the mind-body connection. Good afternoon, Andrew Morris.
Good afternoon, Brian. Hi.
Hi. Where are we talking to you today from? Where are you calling in from?
Now, I'm in the city of Wells in the county of Somerset in the southwest of England. So that's sort of a little south of Bristol and Bath.
And are you experiencing the little heat wave we're having at the moment?
Yes, although this morning's variation on it is fog.
Ah.
So we shall see. I'm sure the sun will burn through shortly.
As long as you're not fog-bound and can't fly on the 3rd of May. You're coming over to Dublin, to Dunleary, for a one-day course, The Mind-Body Connection. Tell us, why is it coming to Dublin? What's it all about?
Well, this is part of the Human Givens College programme of seminars, and the Human Givens approach is a very refreshing and effective approach to helping people with their difficulties in life by really standing back and looking at ourselves from a standpoint that we're an organism, an animal like any other, and that if we understand what our needs are, what our resources are that we use to meet those needs in the environment, then that gives us a really nice, firm, clear footing for helping ourselves and helping each other. And one of the key things about that is that it doesn't necessarily mean we have to put mental health in a completely different sort of category, bracket, frame of reference to the rest of our health. And so this day is really getting in amongst that and understanding quite how integrated health is across the board, and how physical and mental health, at least what we call physical and mental health, how they relate to one another.
And reading the flyer, it's got this kind of triangulation of emotion, exercise and eating, the three E's.
Yes, that's right. That's a nice sort of little sort of mnemonic. It's almost, in a way, a pun. You know, health is dependent on the three big E's. And that was put forward by a guy that did a lot of the work that I'm talking about in the day on the emotion side, how the emotions work in the body. But he says, you know, health is dependent on these three big E's. There's emotion, eating, and exercise. And his little joke about that is, you're always in some sort of emotional state. You eat three times a day, and you might exercise once. But actually, it's a good joke as well. Like all good jokes, there's a lot of truth to it. And in fact, those three domains, what we eat, how we move about and use our bodies, and the emotional states that we're in, are massive determinants of our health across the board, mental and physical health.
I always am surprised when I hear that, but I suppose I shouldn't be. And I'm thinking that if you were a computer, garbage in, garbage out is a term in computing. And if the human is lying on the couch, eating junk food and watching lots of Netflix, that's not going to be good for the emotions.
Absolutely not, because the systems, the human system, if you want to call it that, you know, each of us within ourselves contain almost, if you like, a set of expectations. There's an expectation that your life will need to be led in company with other people, deploying skills, making physical effort. And our bodies have evolved in an environment where certain sorts of junk foods just simply didn't exist. So when our system encounters conditions that it's not well suited to, we tend to suffer in our health in one way or another. That's a very broad statement, but that's a sort of overall way of looking at it.
But we are great at adapting. So we over very short periods of time, probably get used to the TV dinners and the processed food and become accustomed to it. I was going to ask you that, you know, if you lived a perfectly balanced life with emotion, eating and exercise, is it that then you would be giving yourself a fighting chance to be steady? Or is there any kind of data or numbers to say that, you know, it gives you this amount of chance to be a better off person?
I don't think I could sort of put it in those terms, but what we know from, there's a couple of ways that you can look at what happens when people get all those three domains in a good balance. And one of the nicest ones actually to read about is a book called The Blue Zones by Dan Buettner. And in that book, they explore what sort of lives are led in those little pockets of the world where people seem to live for an incredibly long time and very healthily, very healthy, active old age. And we see that, in fact, what those people are doing maps very strongly onto this. They're physically active. Their emotional lives work out well for them. On the whole, their emotional needs are being met. And they eat. They eat a certain way as well. So we can see it working for people out in the world. There's also a clinical program devised by Dean Ornish. And again, when people get these three domains, they seem to be able, what really happens? Life's never going to be perfect. I think we don't want to fly away with the idea that if we can just tick off the right number of boxes that nothing bad will ever happen. This isn't the case. But what we're doing is we're giving ourselves the optimum possible resilience and resourcefulness to cope with what life will inevitably fling at us from time to time. So it's a way really of thinking about getting everything tuned up.
How important is your daily diet?
Well, now, the daily diet really assumes its greatest importance in the day after day after day after day aspect of it. It doesn't really matter too much what any of us eat on one particular day. We can get very sort of upset when we read dietary sort of advice and think, oh, this means I can never have that. Actually, health is determined by what we eat most of the time on most days. And actually, the science is really clear. The more that we eat foods that derive from plants that have had relatively little done to them, and the more variety of those foods we eat, the better our bodies seem to be at regulating themselves, at keeping us in a healthy state. Interestingly, it's not just fruits and vegetables. It's all these plant foods that are whole grains, the peas and lentil family, and the nuts and seeds. And actually, one way of describing a diet that's full of these foods, that consists very largely of these foods, is the Mediterranean diet, which is actually, strictly speaking, the diet of the mountains of Crete. That's what that research idea, the Mediterranean diet, is based on. Now, there's an incredible thing. If you study people that are meant to be following a Mediterranean diet, and you look at the people that complied with that diet the worst, versus the top quarter of the people who complied with it best, the rates of depression are half that in the group that complied best with the diet. And this finding matches in with lots of other similar findings to suggest that actually eating a diet that is full of what I call fresh and or whole plant foods is profoundly protective against depression. There are lots of reasons for that. But it is a reliable thing. We know that people feel better when they eat that way.
So eating natural fruits and vegetable and things like that are good for us. How is it so then that the processed food industry has flourished so much? Like, obviously there's a capital interest in that, but if it's bad for us, surely there must be some, you know, downside for their success.
Oh, well, I mean, the main way that they succeed is by hitting a number of buttons, which we're really programmed by nature to seek out foods. They were rare in nature and very valuable to us. So the three things, if you cast your mind across, brands may differ, of course, in Ireland. So I this may not translate immediately, but things like chocolate hobnobs or ice cream. If you think about any food that you tend to eat compulsively and actually stand back and look at it, what you find is that it is sweet, it is salty, and it is fatty. Now, because salt is often hard to come by in nature, because sweet foods are so valuable for their calories. You know, most animals in nature, and our ancient ancestors included, are, you know, it's getting enough food is a big deal. So if you can find something sweet and if you can find something fatty, you're on to a winner. Our brains really, really respond very positively to this. It's also the case that the original food that we all first consume, which is milk, mother's milk, actually, if you were to concentrate that, you'd have this same triad. There's fat, there's sugar, and there's saltiness. And so we are very driven to seek out these three elements in food. And really, so long as the manufacturer puts some salt, some sugar, and some fat in it, you can pretty much rely on people eating it. I think that's one way of looking at it.
So no accident that it's called a Happy Meal. We'll move on. What is the role of oxytocin?
Well, oxytocin, interestingly, is linked to just that. So oxytocin, if you go to medical school or nursing college or whatever, you'll be taught mainly about oxytocin as a hormone that's produced to start off the process of labor. And in fact, it was in Dublin that the artificial use of an oxytocin was used to induce labor, I think at the Rotunda. So as doctors and nurses, we learn about the use of oxytocin to get labor started and also to initiate the production of breast milk. But actually, it turns out that oxytocin is a really interesting hormone and system in our bodies, and it's all to do with thriving. It's all to do with the body healing itself, growing, nourishing and repairing itself. And in humans, it's really strongly linked to emotional bonding. So that thing when the room disappears and you form that deep, lasting bond with somebody and you never forget their face or their voice, that is all mediated in the brain by oxytocin. So social bonding, trust, all of the lovely, warm, fuzzy feelings like cuddling and stroking and all of that stuff, that is all wrapped up with the oxytocin system. And interestingly, when we eat particularly salty, fatty, and sweet foods, we are triggering not just a relaxation response through the gut, but also oxytocin. So sitting down to eat with people and drink with people is a fantastically powerful way of bonding, because we're all sat around the table in the pub or at the restaurant or at home, and we're all experiencing an increase in oxytocin, and this bonds us together and it makes us feel really, really good. So for a lot of people, you know, these rich foods are bound up with special events and special people. And of course, like all good things, we can overdo it. If we just do that all the time, if we're eating nothing but those foods, it's a problem.
And I'm wondering here, it might be outside your expert area, but is that oxytocin delivered when we socially bond in a virtual sense with our overuse of social media?
Well, I'd love to know the technical answer to that. What we know is that the things that enable us to release the oxytocin are actually eye contact and touching specifically.
Which aren't virtual.
Now, in the virtual world, of course, you know, as anyone who's used Skype for a video call will find, the eye lines are all out. You're actually looking past each other all the time, but I'm not actually aware of any actual research on that. But I suspect that the system's designed to be triggered by actual face-to-face contact, and I think that online it's quite easy for that to get disassembled, that original stimulus, if you see what I mean.
I think it's that point where further research is needed. Can I ask you about lifestyle changes and its ability to augment the effectiveness of any psychotherapy or counselling that you might be attending or going through?
Yes. Now, there are two big arms to this. The first thing is exercise, which is, you know, if we keep mental health in a bracket with on its own, separate from physical health, we might easily miss this. Exercise is an incredibly powerful tool to use to help with anxiety, for instance. The brain it actually produces calming chemicals when we exercise. And also, what we're often doing is there's a certain amount of built-up fight and flight in the system, which is certainly what happens when we worry, when we're anxious, or when we're angry. Exercising, particularly sort of intense exercise, will often release that that sort of preparation that the body's making when it goes into fight and flight. Fight and flight, so what we would call anger or fear in everyday terms, those are preparations for intense physical effort. The body is gearing up literally for a fight or a flight. And so when we exercise, we're using that up. We're actually using it for its original purpose. And that then it can enable us to move on. So there's these calming effects and these discharging effects, which are almost astonishingly valuable. And what I've found in my clinical practice is that, particularly for young people, I often would see people that have been through school and university, exercising regularly, maybe taking part in team sports. They get into a job where, you know, suddenly they're commuting further, they're sat at a desk, and they become more and more anxious. And actually, when you look at what's now missing from their life, it's often just the exercise. They need that regular calming and discharge from the exercise.
I've never thought of it in that way before, that there's adrenaline and it comes from a gland, but if you're not using it up, it's building up like a bit of a pool of adrenaline, and then it can seep out in a negative way.
I think, yes, the systems, I'd use this word expectation. This is a very human givens word to use, but the system is expecting to some extent, either at a low level or, I mean, if we're in full panic, we're really, really geared up. But at some sort of level, we're expecting fight or flight. And of course, I'm glad that you mentioned the adrenaline there, because some people that have been very anxious for a long time will avoid exercising for this simple reason, which it's really helpful if they can understand this, which is that when they start to exercise, of course, the body actually secretes some more adrenaline often. The body gears up for the exercise itself. And so people that have been very anxious for a long time may actually experience this as a worsening of their state. And what's important to realize is that, in fact, once you go through that, you'll feel so much calmer afterwards and so much better. And it'll be so much easier for you to sleep well. It'll be so much easier for you to balance yourself through the rest of the day.
After the exercise, you need the rest and you need to restore. Tell us a bit about that.
Absolutely. So we talk a lot about fight or flight. Our brains are adapted to pay attention to surviving in the immediate sense before we turn our attention to other things. But it actually, in the long run for our health, these other systems, oxytocin is one, but this rest and restore response is absolutely vital. We tend to think sometimes of relaxation as just not being tense anymore. But in fact, in the body, there is a special system that actually activates, that puts us back into the state where we go back into what you might call a resting and maintenance state. It feels very relaxing to be in that state when you go fully into it. And it's like the default mode. It's like the mode that our body wants to run along in just to keep itself ticking over. And that's all connected with a system in the body which some people may have heard of called the parasympathetic.
So at what point is the body telling you that you need to take a break, you need more sleep, and you need to have that rest and restore?
Now, that's a very interesting question. How's it telling you that? It's usually because you're feeling, you're not feeling good. Because the fight and flight response is about survival, we can often miss those subtle cues that we need to rest. It's well known in sort of stress management circles that people tend not to notice too well when this is beginning to happen, when they're beginning to top out in terms of the amount of stress that they can handle. And this is why it's really, really important to have a life that works for you, a life that features regular opportunities to relax, to spend time with friends, just to spend downtime, just to spend time as we used to all do more before we had the internet, just staring out of the window. Or more formally, you might meditate or do some other practice like yoga or Tai Chi. We need these things built into our lives because we're apt sometimes to forget about them. So they're very, very important.
So thinking of daydreaming and looking out the window, you'd be a fan of that?
Yes, we know that daydreaming is very, very productive. It's productive in every way.
That leads us to the care and connect. So that's the bit where it can be care for yourself and it can be solo care. But then the connect is that you say we need to have human connection with other people, which is all part of this mix.
It's all part of the mix, because this relaxation system and the care and connect system are very closely tied in. A lot of the things that activate the one will activate the other. But I think the key thing to mention to mention here about this relaxation response is that there is a very basic, very powerful way that we can stimulate our relaxation response, and that is through breathing. And in fact, breathing in a particular way. And if you look at a lot of very relaxing activities, we'll often find that people are spontaneously breathing in this particular way. It's a slow breath. It's about 6 breaths a minute. And you're tending to breathe just using the diaphragm. So the belly is expanding as you breathe in and just gently sinking back as you breathe out. The muscles around the shoulder and the chest are completely relaxed. These aren't big breaths, not deep breaths in that sense, but you are breathing. It feels like you're breathing in and out of the belly. And that slow breath cycle, breathing in for about 4 seconds and out for about 6, that over time will stimulate a profound relaxation response. And one of the strange facts about this is you can find it embedded in all sorts of things that people do to relax. And my favorite one of these is smoking. If you look at the way most people smoke a cigarette, they're exactly breathing in like that. They tend to breathe in for about 3 or 4 seconds. They will often hold their breath, which also helps stimulate the relaxation response.
Breathing. And then let it out.
And then they'll blow out long and slow.
And as an ex-smoker, that exhale can be more enjoyable than the inhale and the hold.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in a sense, the tragedy but opportunity of understanding smoking from this perspective is that you didn't really necessarily need the nicotine or the smoke. That had you spent that cigarette's worth of time just breathing in for about 4 seconds and then blowing out through your pursed lips nice and slowly, you'd have been super chilled at the end of that time.
Let's be clear, we're not promoting e-cigarettes or tobacco.
No, I'm doing the opposite. What I'm pointing out to people is that, you know, they didn't need the cigarette for that. They don't need a device. You just need to know that that's the breathing pattern that will help you to relax. And indeed, I will often, when I'm helping my patients as a GP to understand their smoking and to make changes when that's what they want to do, I'll often encourage them just to try to pretend smoking a cigarette, breathe exactly as if they were smoking and actually mime the whole thing out for about the length of time it takes them to smoke a cigarette. And then if at the end of that time they still feel they need one, well then, you know, then they've got a choice at that point. But it gives people a way of stepping back from the tobacco, stepping back from all of the harms that come from the smoke, because the breathing and actually the nicotine itself are really benign. It's the smoke. It's the way we deliver it that is so very harmful.
The Mind Body Connection is a 1-day course, and it's on May the 3rd in the Royal Marine Hotel in Dunleary. It's been organised by the Human Givens Institute, and the web address, if you want more details on this, is dublinhumangivens.ie. Andrew Morris, just one more thing before I let you go. Have you been to Dublin before?
Never been to Dublin, and I'm very excited about coming, I have to say. I'm really looking forward to it.
Maybe you could get a trip to the Rotunda Hospital, where they do have tours, and you can see some of the older part of the hospital.
I might try and take that in. Who knows? I'll have a bit of a day before the talk, yes.
Thanks for your time today, and the very best of luck on May the 3rd.
Thank you very much, Brian.
You're with Mental Health on 103.2 Dublin City FM. I'm your host, Brian Green, and if you want to include something on the programme, if you've got an idea, an event coming up or an interview idea, email mentalwealth@dublincityfm.ie. Some events coming up in the city for you. A night with the Media Lab, plus Entertainment Psychology Lab. This is on in the Liquor Rooms on Wednesday night at 6 o'clock. It's all part of a Banter Yard Festival, and you can hear things about smartphones and the way we live today. Talks like why the benefits of music listening on smart devices is more important than the screen time risks. and separating the people from the devices. Where do we draw the line? That's A Night with the Media and Entertainment Psychology Lab, part of Banter, and it's on in the Liquor Rooms at 6 o'clock on Wednesday. Admission is €6. Anxiety, panic, anger, depression, help for anxiety, depression, OCD, bipolar and panic. It's on in the Methodist Church in Clontarf on Wednesday at 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock. It's free and you can get all details at Eventbrite. Celebrating 21 years of mental health research and scholarship, A Journey. It's organised by the School of Nursing and Midwifery at Trinity College Dublin. Admission is free and it runs from 1 o'clock to 4:30 on Thursday afternoon. The location is Trinity College Dublin and the event is free. Celebrating 21 years of mental health research and scholarship at TCD. Headspace 2018 is a two-day free event at Trinity College Dublin. It starts on Friday at 9 o'clock and runs through till Saturday at 6 p.m. Headspace 2018 is a two-day celebration of scientific creative investigation into brain health and dementia. We invite you to join us in conversation about caring communities, research and cultural solutions that will inform, engage, entertain and inspire. It's absolutely free. It starts the 27th of April. It runs to the 28th and it's in Trinity College. It's called Headspace. Tickets for free at Eventbrite. On Saturday, Mindfulness Practice in Schools Conference 2018. This is their fourth annual conference and it's on in Rathmichael, Ferndale Road in John Scousus Secondary School. It starts at 9 a.m. It runs through till 4. They have loads of great talkers, including Enda Murphy, Paul Moss and Dr. Anne Caulfield. That's in Rathmichael, which my geography tells me is near Shankill in Dublin, and it's €75 for that event on Saturday. It runs from 9 till 4. An event we will cover in much more detail next week is Paint Your Bump in Aid of Maternal Mental Health. It's on the 2nd of May 2018, and yes, you can have your bump if you're expecting a baby painted, and it's absolutely free. It's on in Santry Scouts Den, 66 Lorcan Green, Beaumont, and they're on Facebook at Paint Your Bump Day. We'll be talking to Paint Your Bump Day all about what they're doing for mental health on next week's programme. That's Tuesday at 12:30. Have a great week from myself, Brian Green. Until then, take care. Bye-bye.